My name is Heather Scarley, and I'm chairing this session. And it's my pleasure to introduce Mimi Haddon, who's a PhD candidate in musicology at McGill University. She's writing her thesis under the supervision of David Brackett. Her dissertation is originally titled, What is Post-Punk? Pop on the Edge of the 1980s. And her research focuses on unpopular popular music, issues of race and gender identity, and music's intersection with other artistic disciplines, such as literature and film. She's also worked as a journalist for publications such as The Quietus and Dazed. And Dazed and Confused. So she's changed her paper title slightly from what's in the program. So I think this is the new title. Mm-hmm. Mimi, it's over to you.
Thank you. On May the 4th, 1979, Margaret Hilda Thatcher entered number 10 Downing Street as Britain's first female prime minister. In a recent obituary written by Anne Perkins for the Guardian newspaper, her 11 years of leadership were described as watershed. With a firm belief in the authority of the individual as the cornerstone of her policies, Thatcher's government resulted in the devaluation and near permanent annihilation of the country's belief in collectivity and the ideals of full employment and a managed economy. Thatcher's conflict with and eventual destruction of Britain's trade unions in the early to mid-1980s, as well as her privatisation of national industries such as those of coal, steel and telecommunications, were manifestations of her lack of ideological investment in the notion of a collective or public sector. Furthermore, the implementation of these policies, which prioritised individual effort over the interests of community, hammered the final nail in the coffin for the UK's already damaged and ailing large-scale industries. From March 1984 to March 1985, the planned closure of 170 working British collieries resulted in one of the most notorious conflicts of her administration, the miners' strike that eventually decimated several former industrial communities in the north of England. It is perhaps no coincidence, then, that images of large-scale manufacture teetering on the edge of demise began to appear in the rock music press with increasing frequency slightly before and during Thatcher's election, especially in Britain. Images of blown-out factories and polluted canals were secured to the music made on both sides of the Atlantic by musicians who are now considered to be part of the genre known as post-punk, a period of music from approximately 1978 to 1984. Indeed, one of the numerous threads that join together the otherwise very disparate musical sounds of the genre is its association with the post-industrial urban spaces in both northern England and parts of the so-called Rust Belt in the United States. Focusing on the British groups Cabaret Voltaire from Sheffield and Throbbing Gristle from Hull, as well as the American groups Devo and Pear Ubu from Akron and Cleveland, Ohio, this paper examines the precise nature of the interconnection between post-punk and ideas and images of industry. Using the rock music press as my point of departure, I concentrate particularly on musicians' origins in former large-scale manufacturing cities such as Sheffield and Cleveland, discussing similarities between these urban locales. I then explore post-punk musicians' purported incorporation of industrial sound into their music, highlighting in particular their decision to employ noise-generating equipment, in addition to more conventional rock instrumentation. Finally, returning circuitously to Baroness Thatcher, I suggest that rock critics interpreted the use of noise in post-punk as an oblique statement upon the economic sea changes felt in both Britain and the United States. I argue that their appraisals perhaps voice nostalgia for the sound of industrial grime in light of the post-Fordist replacement of people with machinery and/or computerized technology. In August 1979, the same year as Thatcher's election, the Manchester sewer system collapsed. At the end of his interview with Manchester group Joy Division, Paul Rambali, a journalist for NME, used this image of city squalor to allude that the city and perhaps the entire country was literally going down the drain. A comparable picture of urban demise was painted by Pete Silverton of Sounds magazine in his 1978 appraisal of the recent success certain Ohio groups had found in the UK. In order to set the scene for Devo and Pear Ubu, Silverton felt it necessary to remark upon the occasional smell of rubber hanging over Akron, and the charming Cuyahoga River, which flows from Akron up to Cleveland into Lake Erie, which had been officially designated a major fire hazard. In addition to drawing attention to the urban origins of these groups and the potentially squalid appearance of the cities themselves, scarred by large-scale manufacturing practices, British journalists also employed images of industrial cities to draw parallels between cities in the UK and those in the US. They seem to have found it rhetorically or poetically effective to test the limits of this direct equivalence. In the same article from Sounds, for example, Silverton wrote, "The most striking thing about Akron to English eyes is that while it's a medium-sized industrial center, famed capital, rubber capital of the world, no less, it's predominantly suburban in the way that English industrial cities like Sheffield could never be." While Silverton's comments only extend to comparing the industrial character of Akron and Sheffield, but eventually disavowing any strong resemblance, other journalists, such as Simon Reynolds, have equated US and UK cities more directly, along with their musical scenes and their aesthetic sensibilities. Reynolds suggests that the flammable and crud-choked Cuyahoga was the new Mersey, the river that runs through Liverpool, home of the Beatles, and the oft-cited place of British rock. These industrial or former industrial cities, he continues, share a special psychology. They are places that were formerly prosperous, where the residue of wealth and pride make a rich loam in which bohemia can grow. Furthermore, even though commentators on popular music have attributed the genre designation industrial to Throbbing Gristle, Reynolds argues that Ohio bands built that buzzword too. Another point of connection between the US and UK urban post-punk scenes, beyond the greying looks and choking smells, was the way in which the musicians themselves transformed former industrial spaces into sites of musical productivity. John D. Rockefeller's first warehouse on the Cleveland Flats was one of Pere Ubu's creative spaces. Likewise, Cabaret Voltaire used to rehearse in the Old Western Works in Sheffield, a former steel manufacturing business and later headquarters of the Sheffield Federation of Young Socialists. In their interviews, post-punk bands in both Britain and the US are marked by a kind of second city syndrome. That is to say, the musicians and journalists alike demonstrate a self-consciousness about their decentralization and what it is like to develop as artists far from the dominant scenes of London and New York City. Sheffield correspondent for the NME, Andy Gill, wrote that until 1977, Sheffield was undoubtedly musically the most inactive city in Britain, and the prospects for bands working outside the working men's club circuit were absolutely non-existent. Drift South, young man, and drown was the order of the day. Gill's suggestion that the vibrancy and action of Britain's music scene was in the South, that is, in London, was reiterated by bands such as Cabaret Voltaire and even Throbbing Gristle, who eventually moved from Hull in East Yorkshire to Hackney, a district in the East End of London, also scarred by the death of industry. Chris Watson of Cabaret Voltaire remarked, "In some ways, staying up in Sheffield has helped us because we've developed at our own pace and how we've wanted to. But in other ways, we've got no recognition for what we've been doing because nobody's known about us, really." As both Gill and Watson suggested, the Sheffield of the late 1970s was formerly prosperous but with little to no music scene and psychologically, if not geographically, distant from London. The city was thus both a creative and stunting force on Cabaret Voltaire. Similar kinds of frustration are also evident in the comments of Devo and Pear Ubu with regards to making music in Akron and Cleveland. Devo's bass and synth player Gerald Cassell is quoted by Reynolds as saying, "No one will ever know what it took for us to get out of Akron," implying that the city, like Sheffield, had a dearth of cultural vivacity. Singer David Thomas of Pere Ubu told Ian Birch at NME that even though Cleveland has its musicians, there's literally no place to play. The lucky ones go to the sleazo dive war zones and they play for four or five drunks off the street. Cleveland works in a vacuum. There's Cleveland and the rest of the world. Two or three gigs a year there is a lot. There's no escape from Cleveland. To go into the outside world is a very strange thing. Failure is built into everything here. Everyone outside thinks you're stupid, and everyone inside supports that. Like Cabaret Voltaire in Sheffield, then, Devo and Pere Ubu found their own second cities to be wastelands, zones bereft of musical and cultural activity, saturated with an attitude of disinterest and low aspirations, and scarred by the traces of large-scale industry. In his book Music and Urban Geography, the late scholar Adam Crims outlined his methodology as one that sought to reconnect the often assumed unrelated worlds of culture and economics. His aim was to depict, quote, broader urban change and specifically musical practices as particular locations in a single mode of production, capitalism, at a certain point in history, end quote. While I do not wish to propose what sociologist Georgina Bourne would call a homology, that is, a purely reflective relationship between the identity of post-industrial cities and the sound of post-punk music, I would like to explore Crims's idea of a confluence between economics and culture, of urban change and musical change, as mutual conditions of possibility. There are a number of ways to explore the sound of industry in the music of the groups I have been discussing. From scrutinizing their own comments about absorbing the sound of steel mills going flat out all day and all night, to analyzing their metoric repetition, their use of metoric repetition. But for the second half of this paper, I would like to focus specifically on the introduction of new kinds of musical instruments and equipment that have been cited as generators, as it were, of a sound that was heard as particularly industrial. One commonality between journalists' articles on Pere Ubu, Devo, Cabaret Voltaire, and Throbbing Gristle is the idea of their incorporation of sheer noise, or their emulation of non-musical sounds. Ubu were noted for their hiss howls and blistering white noise. According to Pete Silverton, Devo made the sound of avant-garde cash registers. And for writer Chris Needs, Throbbing Gristle evoked the hum of a great generator about to overload or explode, or my personal favorite, a 20-foot long vacuum cleaner. In almost all cases, critics attributed these abrasive modern noises to the synthesizer. In the words of one critic from New York Rocker, in Pere Ubu's song Real World, the band create the atmosphere of urban America by using the synthesizer, which blends unobtrusively with the other instrumental parts to produce telephone bleeps, sirens, and buzzsaws. What is interesting about these comments is that up until this point in rock music history or practice, the vogue for synthesizer playing had revolved primarily around the emulation of other instrumental sounds, whereas groups like Ubu, Devo, Gristle, and Cabaret Voltaire employed synthesizers, in the words of John Savage, as instruments with tonal qualities of their own. So here's a bit of Cabaret Voltaire. Oops. Even though in 1978 synthesizers were by no means new instruments, post-punk's approach to playing them and weaving their timbre into their sonic landscape was marked by at least two distinct novelties. First of all, their playing style was a reaction against the way synthesizers have been incorporated by other rock outfits, and secondly, this difference in playing style was closely bound to the details of instrument design. In an article in Sound on Sound magazine in 2010, Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo declared that the band were big fans of British glam rock group Roxy Music, specifically their synthesizer player Brian Eno. Mothersbaugh and Devo were attracted to Eno's synth playing primarily because it was not like that of Rick Wakeman and Keith Emerson, who, according to Devo, just sounded like glorified organists. The instrumental break in Roxy Music's 1973 song, Editions of You, was especially inspiring to Mothersbaugh, marking the first time he had heard a synthesizer used in such a shocking way. Henceforth, Mothersbaugh et al. Sought sounds like, quote, V2 rockets and motor blasts, things that weren't on the settings when you bought the synth. They thus became what journalist Sam Inglis has called pioneers of everything from circuit bending to multimedia art. From a more embodied perspective, Ubu synth player Ralph Allen Ravenstein avoided the cliches of ELP in part by using an EML, Electro Comp 200, a notably keyboardless analog synthesizer originally built for educational purposes by Connecticut's Electric Music Laboratories. By not playing a keyboard or organ-like instrument and thus falling into its shapes and fingered patterns, but working with knobs and patch cords instead, musicians like Ravenstein could carve out a different approach to incorporating the synthesizer into their songs. In terms of musical style, the groups I have discussed run the gamut from the more conventional guitar-based rock sound of Devo to the all-out sonic insanity of Throbbing Gristle. What these groups share, however, is a penchant for experimenting with machine-generated noise, often produced through the use of synthesizers such as the Electro Comp 200. Even though the use of synthesizers, drum machines, and pre-recorded material was not exclusive to post-punk, indeed it was common to many other neighboring genres, including disco and krautrock, though it carried slightly different significance in these contexts, the association of these devices with images of the working world as a trope established by the British rock press was a peculiar feature of the post-punk discourse. To return to Crims, then, he suggested that perhaps the most characteristic economic changes to take place from the 1970s to the mid-1980s were deindustrialization, that is, the departure of heavy manufacturing from cities such as those discussed, and post-Fordism, that is, the increase in information-based businesses spurred by developing computer technology. In their comments and descriptions of post-punk, rock critics captured these two main facets of late 1970s working life. While the hum of the great generator was increasingly becoming a thing of the past, the sounds of post-Fordism, the telephone bleeps and cash registers, so characteristic of late capitalism, were beginning to irrevocably alter the soundscape of the Western world. Thank you. Sure. Yeah. Okay, Mel.
Great game, that was really, really great.
Thanks.
When you played that Cabaret Voltaire excerpt, it was funny because what it made me think of was Bowie's Berlin Trilogy.
Yeah.
And then you brought up Rhino, and I was like, well, yeah, exactly. It seems so. I was wondering if you thought about that and that location of that in Berlin that has been so emphasized by Bowie and Eno, and also and even just Eno's ambient work from the late 70s, which is certainly not nearly as aggressive as a lot of this, or with the rhythmic drive of a lot of it, but has a lot of the same timbral and sort of sonic evocations of sort of, you know, these spaces in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. I was actually going to use the Berlin Trilogy for another chapter on kind of like Teutonic aesthetics and neo-Nazism. But the idea of incorporating that as a kind of landscape and soundscape based off the back of Bowie into this project would be a really good suggestion. It's something that
there's the space, you know, that sort of liminal space of Berlin.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good idea.
How that might translate between the post-industrial movement and then just the demilitarized zone liminality of West Berlin.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. Look into that. Alan?
Yeah, great paper. I'd love to see you sort of reviving an interesting thing. Your comment about the homology, the notion of the structural homology, you know, you don't map social conditions onto the music. And I found with punk, there was that tendency to equate it with working class angst, with this kind of spontaneous outpouring somehow.
Yeah.
And in fact, I mean, working with, well, Simon Fritz for one and many others, you know, actually sort of stripped away all of that nonsense that actually made us realize it was pretty much a fabricated scene in many ways, the clash with the situation of slogans and their, this equation or linking that you're making between these bands and this post-industrial landscapes, I think it's there to be made, but I think there's much more to say. And each of those four bands, you're talking Voltaire, Gristle, Fabian Gristle, Beagle, and
Perubin, yeah.
They all have, but maybe with Beagle less so than the other thing, but their links to the Apple Park are pretty obvious.
Yeah.
And having seen all of those bands performed at the time, the whole part that I am, it really was like performance art, Gristle especially.
Yeah.
And yet I heard nothing of that in there. I think that to move you away from a strictly structural, homological approach, you maybe need to introduce some of that to say there's more happening.
Yeah, no, definitely. And this is going to be part of a chapter. This is just the beginning of a chapter in my dissertation. But you're definitely right about the avant-garde, because the reading that I've been doing about all four of the bands, all of them mentioned Dada. You know, they say that they were, and obviously like the name is in Cabaret Voltaire, right? And also Père Ubu kind of a little bit as well with the reference to and also with Robin Gristle coming out of the art collective that they were part of as well. So, I mean, there's lots to draw on there. It's just I didn't have space for it. But then, yeah, I'll definitely gonna go that way, I think.
I'm curious to know if you've had any thoughts about that. I mean, how does that actually relate to, because what seems like a very socially conscious kind of thing, I think actually starts to crumble a little bit when you realize, well, this is actually avant-garde.
Yeah, very much so. And the reason that I had the J.G. Ballard quote up there as well, which I didn't explain, but I thought it was I thought it was very apt, you know, who would live in a concrete city like this? The reason I had that there was kind of a nod towards this more artistic direction that I'm going to take it in, because not only were they very interested in Dada, but also Ballard and Burroughs as well was one of the big influences. And I think one of the, I can't remember who I was reading, but one member of one of these groups said, you have to bear in mind that this is a time in history where literature was not a dirty word. So even though they were kind of like coming out of these somewhat kind of working class cities, they were still kind of like artsy. So they're managing to kind of straddle that those two seemingly unconnected milieu, I think. So that's why, yeah, that's why I had the Ballard as well. Yeah, cool.
So 1984, you talk about post-punk being 1978 to 1984, approximately that. Mm-hmm. So what are you defining, like, why is 1984 your concluding time period?
Well, it's not mine. The only real literature on this genre of music from Simon Reynolds is Rip It Up and Start Again. The subtitle is 1978 to 1984. His argument is that because from about 1984 onwards, groups started to become kind of more retro. So like bands like The Smiths and REM to a certain extent, kind of looking back to the 1960s a little bit more. Whereas these guys, Frith argues, were kind of marked by more of a kind of like futuristic, kind of forward-looking aesthetic. That's his argument. And I just mentioned it there just to kind of give the vague dates, but part of the project on my dissertation will be interrogating Reynolds' argument about, you know, his, you know.
I just find it really interesting. I mean, you talk a little bit about post-sportism and then post-industrial. Oh, Alan Allen wants to do
that. No, I was just competing with Scott Allen.
Sorry, did you want to jump over?
This is just speculating in a way. Thinking back to being, you know, a kind of fan of some of this stuff and being a teenager in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. That 1984 was a pivotal year in the sense that there was Orwell's 1984 and the future was now. And once that passed, much like kind of the millennium, oh well, now what? I mean, it really loomed as this big date.
Oh, right.
It's going to be 1984. Here we come.
Yeah.
The future that we all remember and have read about. You know, how could we remember the future? I don't know.
Yeah,
but you know, I'm wondering if that had any impact on this. That kind of there was kind of a mental shift away from okay, now what?
Okay, well, hang on, I'm going to jump in though too. Because I think the other thing that I find really interesting is because I live in Sydney, Nova Scotia, which is a very post-industrial community. Right now we have mines, we have a steel plant, and we didn't have this. And so I'm kind of interested in why they're so far apart. These two particular scenes so strongly affected by what's happening in other scenes. They're happening at the same time, but are not do not seem to be as tied into that aesthetic. So that's what I find interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, Reynolds is one of the two guys who, in that book, links post-punk to the kind of new romantic pretty boys with synthesizers movement that comes after. And then it's a short step from there to understanding that disco, in some ways, is part of this. Blondie being a perfect example.
Yeah.
Cabaret Voltaire. Become one of those bands. Joy Division becomes New Order.
Yep.
Becomes one of those bands.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating transition to chart, but it takes you miles away from the central argument that somehow we're linking post-industrial decay with the noise of these bands. Because in fact, it goes off on a whole.
But I think in a way, 1984 is interesting because 1984 is really when, you know, with Margaret Thatcher was re-elected in 83 and in 84 Reagan was re-elected. Mm-hmm. And that was really when sort of the boom of the 80s was really going on. Mm-hmm. And so there was sort of a shift from the sort of the economic stagnation of the late 70s and early 80s. And suddenly there was this sort of economic growth that was finally happening in both the UK and the United States.
Yeah.
So maybe there is a way of linking those things, of the changing economic situation, and a much more optimistic one that starts to take hold.
And to loop us back to Thatcher, which you didn't quite do at the end, would actually be really interesting.
I didn't quite have time.
No,
I was nearly there.
In a practical sense, but in this sense, actually, you know, because I think while there's a problem with the notion of the structural homology, there's absolutely no problem in linking production to its social and political
Yeah.
I think we'll call it there.
Thank you.
Thanks.